This is the NCARB podcast, where you get an inside look at licensure, regulation, and the initiatives shaping the future of architectural practice. I'm your host, Andy McIntyre, Vice President of Marketing and Communications at NCARB. And this season, we're diving into Pathways to Practice, NCARB's multi-year effort to rethink how architects become licensed.
Architecture is the hardware to the software of life, right? It is fundamentally about that interaction, and it makes life easier if we have a built environment that works.
Across 8 episodes, we'll explore how licensure got to where it is today and where it needs to go next. We talk with architects, educators, regulators, and NCARB leaders about education, experience, and the exam, and why each of those pillars is evolving.
And that portion of school where you go from conceptual to real is also really challenging. It's not something you're really gently moved into. It's kind of like you're doing something that's flowy and crazy, and all of a sudden, wait, you actually have to make this work.
You'll hear how the NCARB competency standard was developed, how research is shaping future licensure models, and what a more flexible, competency-based approach could mean for candidates from a wide range of backgrounds.
So we've seen that in our data as the number of reciprocal licenses starts to decrease a little bit, but that number of individuals who are licensed holds steady.
We also tackle the big questions. Why does licensure look the way it does today? Where do candidates face the biggest barriers? And how can we expand access without lowering standards?
Not everybody fits into the same mold. And so having different pathways to licensure, I think, is really important.
Whether you're a licensure candidate, an educator, a firm leader, or a regulator, this season offers clarity, context, and transparency into one of the most important conversations facing the profession.
Does this requirement to complete all divisions of the exam place an unfair burden on any one group or other?
This is Pathways to Practice, only on the NCARB podcast. Please follow the link in the show notes, subscribe now, and join us as we explore the future of architectural licensure.
My name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise, all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. This week on the podcast, I welcome Kyle Barker, founder of Primary Projects, a firm focused on creating more sustainable, affordable, and community-driven housing. Kyle has spent years studying housing models around the world, exploring how design can better support the way people actually live. Through his research, teaching, and practice, he's challenging conventional approaches and offering new ways for architects to think about housing. This is a conversation about opportunity, responsibility, and the role architects can play in shaping a better future for our world. Kyle Barker, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. You and I have been friends for a long time. We've collaborated at Entree Architect. I know a lot about your history, and I love that you are focused on community and housing. And now you've written a book about it. And so that's why I wanted you to come on the show and share your story and share a little bit about what you're doing through the book. Sound good?
That sounds great.
All right. Well, let's start with your origin story like we always do, because I don't know your full origin story. So go back as far as you want to go back. When did you discover your passion for architecture, and who or what inspired you to get started?
Yeah, I think I'm one of those people that kind of knew that this is what I wanted to do since I was little. And it's funny, I grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio, and I'm the first architect in my family. My mom was a psychiatrist, and she had a lot of patients that had gone to architecture school and had not a great experience. And so she, you know, it's funny, I think a lot of parents would be excited if you told them you wanted to be an architect. And she was kind of trying to steer me away from that. And so I was listening to her, you know, because like a good kid. And then I got to high school and I took this aptitude test, and it was like the only thing I was meant to do was to be an architect. Like it was like 90 something percent. Everything else was like 50. You know, like it was just so clear that that was kind of the thing for me. And so she relented and we started looking at schools. I ended up going to University of Cincinnati because it's a great architecture school. and it has co-ops as part of it. So basically like a job study where you alternate between being in school and going and working places. And so through that, I was able to live in Chicago and New York working at firms. And after school, I moved to Boston for a job. It was 2008, so it was kind of a bleak time to graduate from undergrad.
Yeah, that's a rough year.
It was a rough year, yeah. So there weren't a lot of people from my class that got jobs, and I applied to 20 places, and they were all sort of like dream jobs for me, and they were all over the country. My criteria was a place that I didn't have to have a car, and a place that I was like very excited about the work. And so I ended up getting a job at Kennedy and Violich Architecture in Boston. I was there for 2 years. I went to grad school at MIT for my Master's of Architecture, and then ended up staying in Boston afterward, working for a Mass Design Group and Merge Architects. So that was about like a decade long, those two jobs. And then in 2021, I started my own practice. And so what I was telling you before we started recording was that I am not a risk taker. It's just like not my personality. I think some entrepreneurs sort of live for risk. And I think for me, I wasn't a person that always thought I was going to start my own practice. I think at some point in my career, I definitely thought that was primarily like an ego-driven thing. And I thought, you know, I'm happy to work for other people as long as I kind of agree with the vision. And I think the longer I worked for other people, the more excited I got about my specific interests, some of which you mentioned in that intro. And so really diving into like deep aspects of sustainability, of housing that creates community, of how we can move towards greater affordability, not just in like capital A affordable housing, but across the whole landscape of design. And so I got interested in starting my own thing. And so what I kind of ended up pushing me to do it in 2021 was I got a teaching offer at Northeastern in Boston for a year to teach graduate students. And then I had a few people that had come to me and wanted me to do a small project for them. So that gave me some sense of stability. And then actually the biggest one was that I won this design competition called the Roach Traveling Scholarship. And that's what actually led to this book that we're going to talk about. So I'll just tell you a little bit about that. It's a two-stage design competition. It's actually like the oldest traveling fellowship of its kind in the country. It's been around for, I think, over 100 years. And so it's this two-stage competition where they give you a brief on a Friday and you submit your proposal on a Monday. So it's really quick. It's like 72 hours.
Wow.
Yeah. From that, they pick five people to advance to the finals, and the runner-up from the previous year joins. So it's usually like six entrants. And that final stage is 10 days. And it's usually a massive, like incredibly challenging sort of massive scale. So the year that I won, it was designing a data center and a dry dock in Boston, but it had to have this civic component. So, you know, these things that sort of don't go together, you know, data centers are often about like privacy and security. So how could you show people what was going on, but then also create some sort of civic amenity, but, you know, like a 300,000 square foot sort of design proposal. So at the end of that, you present to a jury and they select one winner. That person, at the time I won, it was a $40,000 travel prize to go and do international travel related to a research interest. So I really wanted to win. That was the fifth time I had entered. This is like a story in perseverance. So I made the finals three times. I was a runner-up once, and I won in 2021. And so that kind of combination of things gave me the confidence to leave my job without the kind of guarantee of income. But the thing I was telling you before we got on the call was that like I listened to this podcast, you know, like I've probably listened to hundreds of episodes of this and made like my own little Google Doc with notes, as well as reading a bunch of books. And so it was like, it was really that combination of having some kind of guaranteed income and some things to do, as well as building out those parts of my skill set that I didn't feel like I had gotten as much from, you know, working for other people or from school.
Very interesting. So the firm's name is Primary Projects.
Yes.
Where did the name come from?
It's a great question. I have this Google sheet that's a very embarrassing document of like 300 possible names. And this was before AI.
I have similar documents. Yeah.
This was just me, like anything I could think of. It's shocking how many names are already taken when you start looking between the internet and Instagram. But when I came up with the name, I was really excited about it actually, because I think as a designer, I've always been interested in a clear vision. And I think, you know, architecture is so long, right? Like a project can last I mean, the projects I work on are more at the kind of 5 to 7 year scale on the long end. But if you're working on really big, complex buildings, of course, it can be much longer. And so I think it's so important that you keep your eye on kind of the big idea and have that be the driving force. So the idea of the name was essentially to help myself remember to keep my eye on the big picture.
That's very interesting. Sort of a built-in reminder to stay focused.
Yeah, exactly.
So what are you focused on? What type of work do you do?
Yeah, I mean, I say the most affordable, sustainable, and communal. There have been times, I mean, I think in my external presentation, I foreground housing because it's a thing that I'm incredibly passionate about. I am open to other kinds of work and I do other things as well. But I think actually one of the things I learned from you and from similar kind of podcasts and books was that if you say to everyone, I'm a designer, I can design anything, I think that it makes sense to other designers, but isn't always the most compelling message for clients. And so both in terms of my bandwidth of what I can possibly learn through, you know, like continuing education, reading and research and project work, and in terms of the messaging, I think, you know, I have chosen to kind of mostly focus on housing. And I thought that was enough when I started, just like that broad of a thing. I think I've gotten greater clarity in the last, you know, almost 5 years about what I mean when I say housing, because of course, multifamily housing sounds very specific and I am open to many kinds of it. But I think that I'm never going to compete with firms that do, you know, 200-300 unit double loaded corridor buildings.
Right.
And that's a little bit of a jargony thing. So just for people that aren't housing people, double-loaded corridors, like kind of hotel style, you know, when you walk down a hall and there's rooms on both sides, or in this case, units on both sides. So it's a kind of building that almost designs itself. And, you know, especially with AI, there are programs now that sort of can create double-loaded corridor buildings very quickly. And so that's just not ultimately the thing that I think is the best use of my skills. I worked at a lot of firms that were kind of experts at helping developers figure out really strange sites in the city. So Boston has, you know, and in a lot of big cities, there's not like prime lots left for housing. The things that are left are almost like remainders.
Right.
And so, you know, figuring out how to fit housing on some of these sites is like pulling a rabbit out of a hat. And I worked at a lot of places where we kind of specialized in that. And so I think it makes sense, you know, as I move into my own practice that I can help people with those kind of projects. And then I think people often come to me when they're looking for something that's much smaller, like the sort of infill, but in almost like a semi-urban, you know, not rural, but not like a big city. So yeah. A lot of my work is in Maine and I'm doing things that are at like the 6-unit scale. So it's been interesting to kind of see as I get into it, how I feel like every 6 months, I feel like I have this greater sense of clarity about the kind of work that I'm best suited to do.
Yeah. So it sounds like you niche down to housing and then niche down again to focus on a very specific type of housing.
Yeah. And again, like I would say that's the majority of my work and that's mostly what I lead with in my kind of public presentation. But every now and then people come to me with other things. And it's funny how over the course of a career, you can develop expertise in many kinds of things.
Yeah.
And obviously, if you try to develop expertise in everything, it gets a little messy. But I think it's like, you know, this is going to sound so strange and so far, far away from housing. But my undergrad was actually in interior design, which was kind of treated like interior architecture at Cincinnati. And so I did a lot of, I would say, like institutional, corporate, and commercial spaces while working at firms in addition to the housing. And often those are kind of like the amenity spaces in housing anyway, you know?
Right,
so it's like, I have done a lot of that work as well. And one thing, it's like housing, the things I love about it are it's, you know, the space we spend most of our time in. And I feel like it can be this really transformative thing. There's also an incredible need for it, on and on and on. But those kind of amenity or commercial spaces, the thing I like about those is that they're at such a different time scale. And so housing, because of all the regulations, because of the neighborhood process, et cetera, often stretches out, like I said, over 5 or so years. Those other projects, it's like people want them done ASAP. So it's like you start on a project and Sometimes like some retail projects I've worked on, they've been done 4 months after I started them, which is like unheard of in architecture.
Right. Time is money for retail.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's actually been a pretty nice pairing for me, these two kinds of work, because they just operate at such different timescales. And like having seen a few kind of economic dips, or at least fears of dips that have affected clients, it's been interesting to see how one of those sectors might kind of slow down and the other might pick up.
Yeah.
I also noticed that with housing across like the affordable housing and the market rate housing, they're often, one is kind of moving up as the other is moving down in terms of the market. So it's been useful for me to stay somewhat diversified, yeah, even while trying to be focused.
Yeah. And I think that's a good example and good for listeners, because we always talk about this target market and specializing and becoming an expert. And people often resist that because they're afraid that exactly what you talked about, you know, not having the diversity. But you're a great example of somebody who did focus, did pick a target market, did build an expertise, became known for that expertise. And then because you were perceived as expertise, people came to you and said, hey, you're good at that. Can you also do these types of architecture? And you could say, yes, we can do that.
Yeah.
And so then you do sort of start to broaden out the different types of work you do. But the message that you're sharing is still about housing, right? It's still about the work that you do as a housing expert, and you succeed because of that. And that's a great example of somebody who has focused on a specific market and can still do different types of architecture. Why is housing so important to you? Why did you choose that?
It's funny. When I was in grad school for my thesis, I ended up doing a project that was set in Houston, Texas, and it was about how we could share rarely used objects and spaces in the suburbs. And so at the time, it was the start of like Zipcar and all these other kind of new models of sharing through technology. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about, you know, like the 90-10 rule of that. Well, in this case, I was thinking like we have so many objects that we own as individuals, and we use 10% of them 90% of the time.
Yeah.
You know, we have all these things that are kind of, you know, we have like a ton of plates for when we have a party, and we have a KitchenAid for like making Christmas cookies. And, you know, we have these things that get kind of pulled out like once a year. And so I started off thinking, how can we share those things? And so I created this design proposal that not only were you sharing those things, but, you know, people say that they don't really want like a dining room, for example. And so could we turn the dining room into a shared, almost like co-working space between two neighbors? And this was before the pandemic, and this was before co-working actually, I think, even really existed. But so that project for me was, you know, it was like the tip of the spear or something. I came upon so many things that made me think about housing in a different way.
Yeah.
And so, you know, in the US at least, we have single family homes, and then we have multifamily housing. And those are the kind of two things I knew about. And so through the thesis, I discovered co-housing, which is an alternative model where usually people have kind of smaller units that are, it still has everything that you would have in a home, but it's just a little bit more compact generally. And then it's often at the scale of about 30 units. So the people that live there choose to live there because they want to live in some kind of greater community with one another. And so those units share what's called a common house that has kitchen facilities, laundry, mailroom, you know, a lot of the kind of things that you would have in a multifamily building, but it's designed with community in mind. And so they'll often have weekly meals there. Some places have daily meals, although that's less common. And then they also take a kind of communal approach to how they look after landscaping. People often choose to live in places like this because it's almost like a built-in childcare. So if you have kids, you can have your kids run around in the way that we all imagine or maybe did exist in, yes, like the 60s, and, you know, kind of like our nostalgia for the past. But also often older adults are interested in living this way because there is like a built-in community and a kind of cross-generational exchange. And I mean, we have a loneliness epidemic in the United States, so there's also reasons why we might want to live this way just for that alone. So I think, like I said, that thesis kind of got me down this path about communal living. And then I think the longer that I've been on this path, the more urgency I've seen in, you know, I mean, I guess part of the reason why I graduated in 2008 and it was so dark was because of the housing crisis we'd had in the country, but there were like the economic recession fueled by housing speculation.
Yeah.
And so I think for me, housing has been this thing that, you know, we need to look at it in terms of affordability, community, as I was saying, but then it also seems like one of the greatest sectors where we could advance sustainability as well. And so it just feels like this microcosm of kind of like the greatest challenges of today all in one thing. And it happens to be the thing where we spend a lot of our time.
Yeah.
So to me, it feels incredibly exciting as a designer. And it's really hard. So I think it's also the challenge is interesting to me.
Yeah. Yeah. And you have massive impact on, you know, hundreds or thousands of people when you do that.
Yeah.
That type of work. So you wrote a book about it. So how did the book come about? You talked a little bit that the book came out of the competition. Talk a little bit about what the book is and why you wrote it.
Yeah. It's a good thing that I lost that competition so many times because I think by the time I won, it was like so obvious to me what I wanted to do. You have to present this proposal to this committee of incredibly impressive architects and they give you feedback. And so my proposal was that I wanted to go around the world and I ended up focusing that to primarily, I ended up going to several countries across Europe, to Australia and Japan. And I was looking at more communal models of housing. And so some of them were co-housing, which is the one I was just describing. But there were a lot of models that are, you know, more like what we would think of as traditional housing. They just happened to be a little bit more thoughtful about the way that the whole thing was laid out so that it created like serendipitous connections between people. And so I went on two trips as part of that. They were each 6 weeks long. The first one was across, Spain, France, Switzerland, Germany, Denmark, Sweden. I forgot Austria. So I kind of went south to north. And then the second trip was Australia and Japan. And I saw like about 55 communities. I went on tours with some of the architects and some of the people that live there. I took over 12,000 photos. So it was like this incredible amount of seeing things, compiling information, like an incredible font of inspiration. And then as part of the requirement of the Roche Prize, you submit a document at the end. And so I thought, rather than just like checking a box, I would love it if this could be a resource for other people who care as much about housing as I do.
Yeah.
It was a little bit of an overwhelming task because how do you capture like that much good and that much inspiration and all these things that are, you know, some of them just feel almost like ephemeral, like a photo can't really capture the thing. I'm also like a very tortured writer. So the thought of creating a book was very overwhelming to me. But it just felt like such a unique opportunity because I think as architects, we often only get photos of something when it's finished. They're very staged photos, which I don't actually mean that as a criticism. I think we want to put our best foot forward. But you know, you're kind of seeing it through a very specific lens. And so you're not really seeing how things have changed over time, how they've kind of been lived in. And you're only seeing like key spaces. You're not getting to see it in its totality. And so the combination of being able to take these photos and talk to the people that live there and the people that design them felt like an incredible thing to not turn into something more enduring. And so I was really inspired actually by, I spent like a year just editing the photos afterward and then thinking about how I wanted to do this. And I'm sure you know Pattern Language by Christopher Alexander and his collaborators, right?
Yes.
And so anyway, for those of you that don't know, it's a great book. Actually, I would recommend, there's like so many affordable copies available, but it has these lessons of how to create like a good home. And that was the purview of his book. And so the structure of the book is that it's lesson by lesson and it has illustrated examples and there's kind of pithy descriptions and then lengthier ones. So for this project, I thought, as I was looking through all these photos, I was thinking about doing case studies. I was thinking about doing all these things. And I thought, this is such an overwhelming amount of data. I think the only way that I can share this with others is to distill it down into lessons. And so I called it the Communal Housing Design Guidelines and broke it down into 40 lessons, which I know 40 is kind of a large number, but you know, it started at like 90 and I kept kind of trying to say which one is like which other one, you know, whatever. And so I broke the 40 further into 7 sections in the book that are some of the key things that you think about when you think about housing. So the sections are circulation, economy, storage, flexibility, privacy, expression, and inclusion. And in each of those, there's a few of those 40 lessons. And under each one, I give like kind of a 4-sentence explanation of what I mean by that term. And then I show photos from the projects that contextualize it with concrete examples. And I try to show a range of possibilities. So I think, as you know, as another architect, building codes vary across countries.
Yeah.
Cultural practices vary. Construction modalities vary. There's all these differences across countries, but there are these kind of things that exist like a level above all that, that are just like based on how we are as humans. And so in the book, I try to capture kind of those things to help both people who are designing, planning housing, but also people who want to procure housing, or even people who already live in multifamily housing and want to adapt it. Some of the things in the book are like paint. You know, they're not like, you don't have to move walls, you don't have to, you know, start ground up. So it's kind of the lessons hit across a range of scales and show people a bit of what I learned. I think that social media has like eroded our attention spans a bit. That doesn't feel like a very controversial take. And so I was also thinking like a book feels a little bit like an old format, but at the same time, I think we all know the website that you go to and then it's like no longer renewed and it's not there anymore and like it's not kept up with. And so a book seemed like something fairly stable. And I also tried to write it in a way that it's primarily caption-based. So, you know, you can read the entire book in like an hour sitting. But so that was my hope, was that people would sit and just kind of like read it with coffee.
Yeah.
And put some post-its on the things that excited them and return to it as a reference.
So a book that's written for our social media unlimited attention spans.
Right.
Yeah. It sounds like a great book. Pattern Language by Christopher Alexander is one of my favorites. It's actually always within my arm's reach. And when I'm designing residential architecture, I'm looking at that for inspiration or cues or, you know, ways to design better. And I love the idea that for anyone who's designing housing, that this could be one of those books where you just look through it and be inspired or make sure that you have this and make sure you have that. And these are different ways that you can do each one of these things successfully. I think that's a great way to write a book, especially for the way we work today and the way we think today.
Yeah, I think it's a great book. I agree with you. And I liked how it kind of functions almost like a, well, this is not going to resonate with younger listeners, but like an encyclopedia where you can pop in, you know, like you can pop into it as a reference,
right?
You don't need to read it cover to cover.
Yeah.
You can kind of skim it and then go deeper on the sections that interest you. And so, yeah, I think I was trying to replicate that. And I think it's just my personality. When you read that book today, if you are a nerd like me and you read it cover to cover, there are moments where it feels very dogmatic to me. And that's like not, that's generally not my personality. So mine is a little bit more like things that I have observed that I think contribute to better housing,
right?
And showing you a range. They're more like a spectrum than this is the one way across the lessons.
Yeah.
So that was like how I tried to shift it more towards, you know, my personality and worldview.
Yeah. It sounds like a book that every housing designer should have on their shelf.
I'd love that. And I mean, it's also available in like PDF, and I tried to make it as affordable as possible. But I think if the cost is a limiting factor for people, they can reach out to me. There's a link on my website for both versions.
Yeah. Primaryprojects.org. If you'd like to go check it out. That's the website for the firm, as well as information for the book. And the book is Communal Housing Design Guidelines. Once again, just if you're looking for it, primaryprojects.org. Let's take a quick break to say thank you to our sponsors for their support of this episode. This episode of Entree Architect Podcast is supported by WeCollabify, one of our trusted allied partners. As this community has grown over the years, one thing has become very clear to me. The partners we choose matter. Allied partners are not sponsors. They're not advertisers. They are organizations that we've taken the time to get to know, to work alongside, and to trust. They understand the real pressures of practice and the responsibility that comes with leading a small firm. WeCollabify earned that trust by helping small firm owners address a challenge that sits at the center of long-term firm health, building capacity in a way that supports people, not just projects. Their insourcing model brings skilled design, BIM, and technical professionals directly into your team. They work in your time zone, inside your systems, and part of your day-to-day workflow. That integration allows firms to add capacity when it's needed, scale with intention, and grow without sacrificing culture, leadership focus, or quality of life. If you're thinking beyond short-term fixes and focused on building a firm that lasts, I encourage you, go learn why WeCollabify is one of our trusted allied partners. Visit WeCollabify.com/EntreeArchitect to learn more. That's WeCollabify.com/EntreeArchitect. Gain lessons learned and credits earned with Arcademy, ARCAT's continuing education program. Listen to popular episodes of the Detailed podcast and earn AIA-approved HSW credits. Yes, you heard that right, HSW credits for episodes of Detailed podcast. Listen to an episode, check out the learning objectives, and use what you've learned while listening to take the course. The program is free, it's simple, and can be found at arcat.com under the Resources tab. Or just go to arcat.com/arcademy. That's arcat.com/arcademy. That's arcat.com/arcademy. Please visit our sponsors today and thank them. Thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community. Do you have any ideas or any thoughts for the future of the book? Do you want to just get the book in as many hands as possible? Or do you think that you might have other versions or maybe expand online in some way?
That's a great question. I don't know. It's funny. I just finished writing an essay for a forthcoming book. Like, I'm a contributor in this book and I don't think I'm allowed to talk about it yet. But I was writing a sort of corollary to this about unit designs. And it wasn't specifically about sharing. It was just kind of best practices for multifamily housing units. And as I was writing it, I was thinking, oh, this feels eerily similar. You know, like I'm like, am I just a person who's really interested in principles and kind of like sharing them out? And I think, yes, I am interested in sharing in general. Like, to me, that's definitely like a value of my practice, is that I think we're all better when we share with each other. It's part of the reason that I love Entree Architect. But yeah, so I guess I wouldn't say, you know, never say never. It was an incredible amount of effort and time.
Yeah.
And so I think it would honestly just be that would be the constraint. You know, it was also such an incredible, like at the time I kept thinking, wow, this is a once in a lifetime opportunity that I got to do this travel that's funded by someone else. And then I thought, that's not even the right phrase, right? This is a never thought this was going to happen in my life kind of opportunity. And so yeah, I think I would have to find the kind of funding source that would support it, is the sad, very practical answer.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on the future of housing? Because there's the way we are thinking and living and working is rapidly changing with AI and technology. How do you think housing will change?
Such a good question.
Or will it change?
Yeah, well, I mean, there are, you know, of course, core aspects of our being that are, you know, like our physiology that, well, I don't know. I guess I was going to say feel fixed, but who knows? There's like a cyber link and all these things that
you never know.
Are trying to change that. Yeah, you never know. I think there's a lot of, I guess, potentially specific answers to that question. Like, one thing that comes to mind is, you know, as we have increasing challenges around escalating costs of, you know, materials, also labor, as we had fewer people entering the trades and like labor shortages, I think a lot of people have been looking to modular design of various kinds, whether that be panelized or volumetric, which is when it's more like the trailer kind of size pieces. And I certainly see potential in both of those. I have a lot more experience with panelized, and that is certainly much more flexible when it comes to like a diversity of unit layouts. And smaller things as well, like single family homes. I think people are often understandably looking for a kind of silver bullet answer. And I have a friend named Andrew Frederick who started a company called Croft. And that's the panelized modular company that I work with the most. he jokes that we don't need silver bullets, we need silver glitter that like gets in everything and it's like constantly on your mind. And I do think to me that speaks to the kind of like multitude of strategies that we need to solve some of the crises we have around housing. I think the thing I'm the most excited about imagining for the future of housing is less about how the units themselves change and more about the way we build them. And by that, I don't mean actually modular, which, you know, that could be part of it, but I mean the materials that we build with. And so I think definitely the way that I was trained when I was in school, it was all about, well, materials that are kind of rich in fossil fuels to varying degrees. Right. And I think we were more thinking about operational carbon, like how much it takes to run a building. So we were trying to reduce the energy loads by thickening insulation and, you know, things like that, using LEDs, et cetera. I think once we figured that out pretty well, then we realized how important the embodied carbon is, or in other words, the carbon that's in the materials that we make and how much it like takes to produce them. And so I think in the last 5 years, I've been really focused on that. And I mentioned Croft, but they're a Maine-based company and they have these envelope panels, so like walls and roofs, that are double stud walls. And instead of filling them with a conventional insulation, they're filled with straw, compressed straw. So whenever I say that to people, they say, oh, isn't that going to rot? Isn't that going to catch on fire or whatever? Like, I mean, it's funny because foam is like the most flammable thing that we know of. Bugs love foam. The straw, they have it, it's class A fire rated. It's rot resistant. Straw has a high silica content, so which is like what's in drywall. So a lot of the things we associate with drywall, like good fire rating, fairly good with moisture, straw has as well. And so what excites me about it though is that it's locally grown and it sequesters more carbon than anything else I know of. So just to be quick about this, if you think about straw, you know, it grows incredibly quickly. It draws carbon in while it's growing. We harvest like a tiniest little bit for, you know, like our cereal grains, like rice, wheat, et cetera. But like there's still kind of 99% of the plant left. And so we're not like diverting a food source into buildings or something else. So we're just taking a waste product, putting it in a wall, and then it holds all that carbon that it's already drawn in the wall. So, right. So then the building becomes a carbon sink. So I think like the thing that we have often thought is one of the worst offenders from a carbon perspective, which is buildings, becomes like the way that we could really kind of, not to be so Pollyanna, but like we could solve climate change right. through the buildings.
Yeah.
To me, that just seems incredibly exciting. And so that's what I've been pushing for in my work. And so the single family homes that I've worked on in the last several years have kind of all been designed for that. The multifamily projects, including a 30-unit affordable project in Portland, Maine, is designed with that. So I'm excited to see that scale and to be a part of that. And I'm not the one that has done the smart thinking about it. I'm just the one that like realized how good it was. One of the ones who realized how good it was and is trying to get it into the buildings I work on.
Yeah.
So that's like where I would love to see the future of housing go. And straw's not the only one. It's just the one that I've seen that sequesters the most carbon.
Right, right. I predict a volume 2 to communal housing design guidelines.
Yeah.
Talking about materials, maybe. All right. Well, very interesting. I love what you're doing. I love that you've written this book and I love it as a guideline for books today that, you know, you have to read from cover to cover in order to get the value of it. You had mentioned with pattern language, I only read that book once cover to cover in school when it was assigned to me, but I've referenced it thousands of times. And so I love the idea that it is this reference book, this guideline for designers who are designing housing. Again, it's available at primaryprojects.org. Before we wrap up here, I'd like to ask you this final question, Kyle. What's one thing that a small firm architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
Okay, I have three things, but they're really quick. Okay. One is that designers need to track their hours. This drives me crazy. I don't know how we could price our work if we don't know how long it takes us to do it. Whether or not you charge hourly, you gotta track your hours. And when you work for someone else, it's so important for them. And I know it's not fun, but my strategy is that I have this tiny notebook next to me that I write down as I'm doing it. And I enter it all at the end of the week in one go. So it takes me like an hour rather than chopping up and kind of breaking my flow throughout the day. The other one are just book recommendations. And I think I've actually probably got these from you or from someone else on your podcast to start. So this is a little bit like, you know, recursive now. But
yeah.
The Getting to Yes book has been incredibly important for me as I am now not only the person doing the work, but the person negotiating with clients about how to get paid for the work, how much to charge for the work, etc. I've actually read that book twice because I found it so valuable. The other one is a funny one because I thought it was like one of those silly business books, but I read it recently, How to Win Friends and Influence People.
Yeah.
That book, I think as someone who was never really...
Dale Carnegie.
Yeah, Dale Carnegie. So as someone who was never part of the business development side of the firms I was at, I was more on the kind of marketing push and, you know, doing RFPs and things like that, going to interviews, but I wasn't taking clients to lunch and, you know, emailing clients for new business. And yeah, that book I think is just an incredible resource for anyone who feels like that's not something that they're in quotes good at.
Yeah, that book, How to Win Friends and Influence People, is the first business book I ever read. It was recommended to me by my grandfather, who was a salesman for Schaefer Breweries. And he was the epitome of that book. You know, that's his whole world was around, you know, influencing people and making friends. And everybody, he had thousands of people who knew him and considered him a good friend, and very important book in my career as well. So excellent choice, I would say. Kyle Barker is his name. Primary Projects is the firm. Primaryprojects.org, not .com, it's .org is the website. And if you want to check him out on Instagram, primary_projects on Instagram, go subscribe and follow along. If you're interested in the book is called Communal Housing Design Guidelines, is the name of the book. And that's available also on primaryprojects.org. Kyle, thank you. Thank you for the work that you're doing and the book that you've written and the value that you bring to this profession. You've given lots to Entree Architect and the community that we have here. You're a facilitator. You've done simple systems in the past. Thank you for all of that. And thank you for sharing your knowledge here today at Entree Architect Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Mark. I really appreciate it.
If you enjoyed this episode of Entree Architect Podcast, please share a link with a friend, because that's how we've continued to grow and serve thousands more small firm architects just like you. Thank you to our sponsors for this episode. Links to the sponsors and all the resources we discussed today, they are all available in the show notes for this episode at entrearchitect.com/podcast. Entree Architect is a proud member of the Gable Media Network. It's the multimedia network moving the architecture, engineering, and construction industries forward through the power of storytelling. You can earn AIA continuing education credits by listening to select episodes of this podcast and many others at gablemedia.com/members. And if you are a small firm architect, listen up. Join us today at Entree Architect Network. It's the worldwide community for entrepreneur architects. We've been around since 2012, and our basic level is now free to join. Yes, you can join Entree Architect Network for free, and that gives you access to valuable business resources and our global community of architects. And you can upgrade anytime for live coaching, AIA approved training, and mastermind support. So visit entrearchitect.com to learn more and to get started. My name is Mark R. LePage. Thank you for listening to the Entree Architect Podcast. Love, learn, share.
Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand Podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit
and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short-haul frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.
Imagine earning continuing education credits while doing exactly what you're doing right now. Well, you can. Gable Media has revolutionized the way you earn your continuing education credits with a groundbreaking approach. Forget running around town and scouring the internet for credit-worthy courses. Fulfill your CE requirements effortlessly by listening to engaging podcasts just like the one you're listening to now. Our podcasts are designed to educate, entertain, and inspire, all in a user-friendly environment. But wait, there's more. Architects, Gable Media is also approved as an AIA Continuing Education Services provider. Upon completion, we handle everything, from reporting your hours directly to the AIA to storing your certificates in your personal Gable Media profile for your self-reporting needs. So follow the link in the show notes and start earning your credits in the most innovative and entertaining way possible with Gable Media.